Hello and welcome to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and reports on solutions and alternatives that help protect and preserve a healthy planet. The UN Refugee Agency estimates that by 2050, up to 250 million people will be displaced by climate change impacts, such as rising sea levels, floods, famine, drought, hurricanes, and the negative impacts on ecosystems. Amali Tower is the founder and executive director of Climate Refugees. Amali has worked the past 12 years to promote the protection of refugees and forcibly displaced persons in a variety of contexts, including in refugee settlement, protection, evaluation, and research with the UN Refugee Agency in Kenya and Jordan, various NGOs throughout Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and the U.S., and as a subcontractor to the U.S. Department of State's Overseas U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. Founded in 2015, Climate Refugees is an independent project created to bring attention and action to help people displaced across borders as a result of climate change. Earth Matters spoke to Amali to find out more about climate refugees, but first, a short introduction to the problem, as told by Amali during a New Economies Reporting Project conference call, thanks to the New Economy Coalition at www.neweconomy.net for permission to use this clip.
We don't have any data that determines how many people might be displaced or affected by climate change. And there are several reasons for this. Most importantly is that the climate change is not one of the factors that is considered by international law to render someone a refugee. So let me just kind of begin by, let's talk about terminology is important, but that also is a great stepping point to, or stepping stone to understanding why we're in this dilemma. It's important to understand that refugees are those who have a well-founded fear, who have crossed the national borders of their own country into another, and are fleeing for reasons of race, religion, or persecution rather, on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. You'll note that climate change is not amongst those reasons or grounds for persecution that are protected by international law, and very specifically by the Refugee Convention. So that in and by itself helps you understand why I can't really tell you what the plight of climate refugees are, because we don't know. We don't have data that's tracking to determine are people fleeing for reasons of climate change. And then if they are fleeing or migrating or being displaced, because there are various terms being used here, not only are we not tracking that, B, they wouldn't be protected under international law, and C, they may be moving, but within borders of their own countries, which is by and large that what the limited data is showing. And also as far as scoping the volume of this potential problem, experts contend that most likely people are going to migrate or be displaced. And when you talk about migration, it's important to understand that migration can be voluntary as well as forcible. And so when you talk about migration or displacement on the basis of climate change, it's important really, whichever term you use, to understand is there a forcible element of why people are moving, i.e., does climate change pose an external threat to their lives and therefore they have no choice but to move? And if the answer to that is yes, then we as an international community need to recognize that maybe there's an element of protection that we owe people who are impacted by a global phenomena that they've had no role in playing. So I think I'm talking about these things very broadly because I think everybody on this call understands that in itself is the grand dilemma, right? We're debating whether climate change is happening. B, we're debating who's responsible for it. C, we're debating how exactly we mitigate climate change. And then D, we're not even beginning to discuss what kind of human impact that has on people. So I can tell you that there's a great report by the World Bank called Groundswell that I would recommend your fellows look at, which looked at Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and I believe Southeast Asia, that estimates that as much as 140 million people could be displaced internally by climate change by the year 2050. There are also plenty of other data and experts that say people could be displaced, as much as 50 million people could be displaced. Again, that's either within their borders or out, or leaving their countries, also by the year 2050. So, by 2050, the experts attribute as much as low as 50 million all the way to about 700 million. So we have, you know, large sort of like scoping expert testimony in this area, but it's really the clear lack of data that doesn't really enable good modeling in this area. So what we do at Climate Refugees is we basically try and create field evidence, is to go to climate change hotspots where people are on the move. So last year I was in the Lake Chad Basin. And the Lake Chad is a very large body of water that is diminishing, and it's diminished about 50% over the last 90 years. And the lake is surrounded by Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria. About 38 million people are dependent upon this lake. And the lake diminishing has led to a great number of people being forced to move because they just can't afford their livelihoods. They can't actually thrive because of a lack of rainfall, because of the lake diminishing, because of climate variability, climate change. Those are two distinctly different things. And then enter conflict, the conflict that's ongoing in that region with Boko Haram and all four of those countries. So climate change certainly plays a role in that conflict, and conflict plays a role in exacerbating or impeding any sort of global or regional response to climate change.
How and why did you start Climate Refugees?
Yeah, well, I founded it because I really began to notice that a lot of the refugees that I was speaking to were basically articulating things that related to like a forcible element, but certainly had a climate component to it. And I was hearing this amongst Somalis and all throughout East Africa, and it's something that just kind of like was lodged in the back of my head, but didn't really come to fruition until I had some time to sort of think about it, you know? So we're a nonprofit organization that I founded in order to sort of document cases of climate displacement, because I knew that these were cases that existed. And like I said, it was sort of like subconsciously, you know, from hearing testimonies over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And at the time when I was hearing them, all I was thinking was, well, this isn't a refugee claim. And I would really have to work harder with people because these were populations that I knew also had definite reasons why they had fled that would be covered under a refugee definition. So it's not that they couldn't necessarily be refugees, but it was interesting to note that their own disclosures, their own testimonies were saying things that in the first instance that were really about how difficult their livelihoods were because of climate-related components. So I, you know, what we do is we document cases of climate displacement, you know, where we're new, and it's really about putting a human face on the situation of climate displacement.
Right. Now, you touch on the definition of refugee status according to the UN. Mm-hmm. Is this a problem? Is this a challenge?
Yeah, it is, because the UN defines a refugee as someone who, owing to a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group, has had to have left his or her country, cross the border into another country in order to seek asylum for those five reasons that I mentioned. And you'll note that there's nothing close to climate change, climate, you know, livelihoods, economic distress, you know, there's nothing even remotely close to that area that's protected under that definition, which, you know, was adopted in 1951 in the Refugee Convention. So here we are in a situation, you know, this many years later that doesn't encompass a massive global problem. So, yeah, it is a big problem because if people are being displaced across borders for reasons that don't fall under that definition, then they would sort of get lumped into this category of economic migrants, which the international community has no obligation to protect.
Right.
And therein really lies the rub.
So do you have a handle of roughly how many environmental or climate refugees there are in the world today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really hard to know. Mm-hmm. We don't really know because we don't track this data, and that is part and parcel of the problem. There are, though, some measures being taken. The International Organization for Migration, which, of course, has a mandate, right, to look at migration as a whole, not just forcible migration, but migration.
Mm-hmm.
That means voluntary, you know, as well, has created what's called a data displacement tracking matrix. And they do have this in some locations. And obviously, it's very strategic. They have the DTM, as it's called, in places where we know that there are sort of, you know, stressors and climate change components and definite movements of people that might not necessarily be only conflict related. So that's something that I would point you to look at. The World Bank also just did a very interesting study this year called Groundswell,
mm-hmm.
which looks at climate change related migration and really, you know, sort of like forcible migration. And they looked at, their modeling is for internal migration, for people who stay within their country borders or possibly even like within a region. So they looked at South Asia, Latin America, and Sub-Saharan Africa, and their estimates were that by 2050, as much as 140 or 150 million people will be displaced internally. So there are studies out there. You know, we published a report on the Lake Chad Basin last year, which is a crisis that's primarily as a result of the conflict with Boko Haram in those four countries that border Lake Chad, which are Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria. And as I said, 2.4 million people are displaced, but what's apparently clear from the 105 people I spoke to was that they were unanimous. Every single one of them individually were saying, they were very much speaking about climate change and environmental distress as much of a component for their distress,
mm-hmm.
as conflict and Boko Haram were. I mean, it was, there was no like, oh, this is my first instance, this is my second instance. They might have said, we finally had to flee because we were forced off our land, you know, and there was definitely this, you know, terrorism had really kind of been the final straw, but it wasn't the only problem they had. And then many also spoke of moving long before conflict even affected them,
right,
because of climate change impacts in that region.
Does this affect primarily or only refugees from southern countries, from the southern hemisphere?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. I would say that climate, I mean, that might be what you're seeing because that's what the media tends to sort of like depict, you know, and we're used to seeing, you know, we have certain lenses on like mass migration or mass displacement. We tend to put this in a humanitarian or developmental lens. And then when people are displaced as in Puerto Rico or natural disasters that take place in the Western Hemisphere, we have a completely different lens on this. It's not looked at through a development lens. You know, it's sort of looked as this act of God and oh how sad it is, and the reaction is very charitable, you know, and it's not so much causal or what's the political ramifications or, you know, what should the political response be. You know, the focus is so different on those two scenarios, I think. But what I'd like to say is that climate change does not discriminate, whether it's in sudden onset, you know, climate change that creates natural hazards, natural disasters, you know, or slow onset changes, you know, where, case in point, Lake Chad Basin, you know, where you have a lake that's diminishing or you have, you know, rainfall variability, climate variability, you know, that's creating all kinds of livelihood vulnerabilities. That would be a great example of slow onset changes, you know, it does not discriminate, and it has the has the impact, or has the potential to impact us all. You know,
right.
We're just not seeing it in the same light right now.
Yeah, I'm thinking of things like the drought in California, the wildfires that we experienced in North America. Is the fact that some refugees are displaced internally or temporarily, does that confuse the situation?
Yeah, I think it does to some extent. I mean, for example, you know, I mean, everything I just kind of said about California and about the West and sort of, you know, the developing South, you know, I think still bears in this situation. But I don't know if it's so much confusing as much as obfuscating responsibility. You know, climate change isn't isolated to individual countries, right? It's a collective problem, and it's mostly created by the developed world, which the developing world is bearing the brunt of. You know, so even if they're internally displaced, I think for me the message should be, you know, if the impact of that displacement outweighs a country's ability to handle or respond, then, you know, the focus should really shift to international community should bear some responsibility to help those countries bear the brunt of it. So in the situation of California and such, you know, again, I think it's the lens through which we look at it. You know, I mean, you could make the same argument, you know, is California solely responsible for droughts and the impact that that has on its population and its economy? To a certain extent, you can say for sure, because there are, you know, local government decisions that one could say have been mismanaged, or there could be, like, you know, irrigation and dam policies that, and I'm not an environmentalist, you know, but that's one example that you could point to in the Lake Chad Basin as well, you know, that irrigation measures taken, you know, from a development perspective in those countries have had deep impacts environmentally now as well. You know, but it's a little bit of like one affects the other. You know, they're not isolated. So, yeah, I don't necessarily think it confuses the issue as much as, you know, I mean, it certainly confuses the issue from the perspective of what I was saying about what the definition of a refugee is. You know,
right.
That
right.
creates a real policy problem. But in terms of, you know, responsibility goes, I that's where I think, you know, we have to make that clear distinction that, you know, there really shouldn't be confusion as to this being a collective problem.
Right, right. Let's turn to your organization, and people can find it on the web at climate-refugees.org. Tell us a bit more about
that's
climate
correct.
Refugees and what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, we really want to, like I said, I mean, it's really as simple as we want to tell the stories of affected communities, you know, that the fact that this is happening now, that this is not something that, you know, is something that's going to happen in the distant future or something that, you know, may only happen to developing countries, you know. We really want to be able to put, like I said, a human face on the situation, and really advocate for stronger protections for people that are displaced, whether it be internally or across borders. And in doing so as well, we want to be able to make policy suggestions on the legal front, on humanitarian and development policies and displacement that ensure climate resiliency, that ensure, you know, stronger livelihood programming for populations that are displaced by this. And that showcase that climate change and then the resulting displacement can be major contributors to conflict. They can either contribute to conflict or even exacerbate conflict. Now, our focus has been primarily global, you know, and we thus far have been looking at climate change, the nexus of climate change and conflict. The first report was like Chad, you know, right now we're sort of scoping out our next field mission, and we want to look at that same kind of climate change conflict nexus in East Africa. And I really want to sort of like stay focused right now in this area, because one of the things that we strongly believe is that, you know, climate change is starting to become a topic that is being accepted more or less globally as a major threat to not just the planet, but to international peace and security. And there's becoming a stronger and stronger connection or case being made for the fact that climate change might rise to a threat to international peace and security, which means then that at the global policymaking level, the UN Security Council would have to sort of, you know, weigh in on what factors, you know, or what risk does it pose? And there's a lot of, you know, reticence to have the Security Council weigh in on this, but rightly so. But on the flip side of things, you know, this is the body that we have in our international system that really does have the weight to make some strong policymaking decisions. So what we really want to try and do is show what role climate change may play, you know, in risking conflict or in exacerbating conflict or, you know, in being used as a tool, as a mechanism, you know, just as much as climate change is a factor for development, it can also be a contributing cause, you know, to just worsening sort of very hostile, you know, underlying problems that exist in sort of, you know, weak governments or weak institutions or, you know, post-conflict countries. So this is like really a strong area of focus that we want to take, especially because I think it's kind of missing, you know.
Right. Now, obviously, climate change is a huge, huge issue. And, you know, many countries have signed the Paris Accord. They're trying to institute things like carbon taxes to reduce carbon. That's on the environment side of things. But as far as the refugee situation is concerned, is there more that countries can do? And I was very struck by Nuvo Esperanza in Holyoke that said, look, we're the Puerto Rican community here, and we need to absorb those refugees from Puerto Rico. So can developed countries do more of those kinds of things? Can they open up their doors because there's already a relationship between an affected country and their local citizens? Can we do more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's, at least in that scenario, you know, there is, one would hope, you know, an incentive because you have maybe regional or bilateral agreements, you know, that are strengthened by your relations towards each other. So, if, you know, where, you know, countries have this sort of burden sharing sort of understanding, one would hope, you know, traditionally speaking in international relations that's a pretty accepted mode of operating, you know, but more and more, you know, we have this very sort of closed border, almost xenophobic response to migration all around the world. So, you know, I would say that, you know, one of the first, you know, it's interesting to note that if we just take a step back, I would say that countries can do better by the refugees that they've already committed to protect per that refugee convention definition that I mentioned. And then following that principle, they can apply the similar asylum-seeking procedures to those who may not exactly fit that same criteria, you know, but nonetheless have that forcible element to why they fled and then create avenues and pathways for their protection. I mean, New Zealand is doing this with Pacific Island nations that it doesn't have a share of land border with, but certainly has economic and political and social relations with, right? And like I said, they have those. There's an incentive for them to cooperate and to be collegial towards their neighbors.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great way forward. And in the case of Puerto Rico, as you were just mentioning, that our colleague was talking about, I mean, that's just shocking. First of all, that's not even the same situation. These are U.S. citizens that the U.S. government bears
responsibility
for.
Yeah.
And one could, you know, we could have an entire conversation about whether it's doing that.
Are we under a time constraint? Is, say, 2050 too late to act? Do we need to act tomorrow?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think all the science, especially the latest IPCC report, I'm sure you've read, I would say that if we wait till 2050 to do anything, then yes, I'd say we're likely, as per many experts, too late. But you know, history tends to show that we as a global community react rather than prevent, mm-hmm. Or rather than mitigate. And I mean, with climate change, you know, you hear the word mitigate all the time. Yeah. With conflict, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? You're conflict mitigation, conflict resolution, and now you're hearing climate mitigation, you know, climate resiliency. It's like similar sort of thinking, which I think could be positive. You know, it's probably the stance we need to take. But yeah, it doesn't seem like we're doing enough now. But I would say it's definitely going to be too late by 2050. Yeah.
And finally, how can listeners help with the climate refugee crisis in general and in conjunction with climate refugees?
Well, with the climate refugees issue in general, you know, I would say at the individual level, you have to sort of advocate with your governments, you know, to say that you would like to see your countries, your states, you know, if it's here in the United States, for example, you know, ask your local at the municipal level, you know, at the federal level, at the global level, advocate for change, advocate for policies that are more inclusive, that look at things from a holistic perspective, you know. And for our organization particularly, you know, I would say the best thing that we need is help to fund and support our work. I'll go back to the Lake Chad crisis because that is the only report we've done so far. I mean, we just came together in 2016. So one of the things that is interesting about that conflict is that the UN Security Council did travel to the Lake Chad Basin, which was rather unprecedented for the council to do. This wasn't even a conflict on its agenda. And one of the things that came forth was a unanimous resolution that looked at the conflict, you know, generally, but also in specifics, and brought out that climate change and underdevelopment were root causes contributing to the conflict. Now, that's huge, as I, you know, for all the reasons that I've already articulated. The other thing that resolution asked for and the Global Compact on Migration that's now going to be adopted at the end of the year are all asking for is more data, more risk analysis. And we applaud this because one of the reasons why I founded this organization was to do exactly that, right? To put a human face on the situation, but not just to tell pretty or sad stories, but to provide data, to provide testimonies of people, to provide numbers, to provide, you know, all the sort of like unintended consequences of climate change, and to provide that level of analysis, political, social, economic risk analysis. And that's what we are doing, and that's what we want to continue to do. And I think what we're seeing from that resolution, from the Global Compact for Migration that the UN will adopt at the end of the year, from all the COP, you know, Conference of the Parties processes that go on climate change, what's clear is that our stance of wanting to document these cases is there's a need for. There's more and more of a need for that. So at the individual level and at the country level, we would love, you know, if people would support that work, because obviously it's not easy to do, and it's not even easy to travel and access these places. And we have to do it in partnership, but we need support to do that, you know. So right. I would say that go to our website and donate if this moves you.
Okay. Amali Tower, founder and executive director of Climate Refugees, thank you for joining us on Earth Matters.
Thank you so much for having me, and all the best to you.
Okay. Bye-bye now.